A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hey, Herman and Corn. So some of these episodes in the podcast are intended for general appeal. We talk about interesting subjects. I think these will be, you know, hopefully of interest to other people. Some of them are, I'm not sure any other human is going to find this informative or interesting. Nevertheless, because I'm the person paying for the generation of these episodes, I'm going to make it. And if no one else listens to it, that's okay. Although it'd be cool if someone did. We're going to try get to the bottom of the marker mystery, or debug my failed markings, Herman and Corn. We did an episode before about industrial markers, which sounds like kind of a weird niche thing, but they're kind of useful. And in the context that I'm talking about, which is, I mentioned I built up this home inventory system, and you know, it's a pretty straightforward system. It was forked from something called Homebox, and basically, the essential system is that you inventorize your belongings, not everything you own, but let's say, I don't know, a computer monitor, an AC controller that you're always misplacing. That gets created, it gets a number automatically assigned, and then you have storage boxes and or storage locations. They get numbers too. And then the last thing is just putting physical markings to connect them. I mentioned that I started out with QR codes, which is what the system is designed for. They work great. You just scan it with your phone. But they do tend to degrade over time. I tried NFC tags, nice as well. They tend to come off. Ultimately found that industrial labels are the most durable things. However, there are things that you just can't really get a label onto. It might be an electronic component or a lot of the same things that people might actually create these systems because they have a lot of loose and small electronic parts, which is exactly my situation. I have, from days doing videography work, audio editing, bags of stuff like XLR to 3.5, 3.5 to XLR, micro to mini HDMI. These are the type of things that I created the system for because I might need it for a shoot and I could literally waste an hour going through boxes trying to figure out where that tiny little connector was. So when you have things like this, they're small, they're specific. This is where the system actually comes into its own. You just need to figure out some way of getting an identifier onto them and put them in a box that's noted in the system. And then the next time you need it, go to the box, return it to the box. Suddenly, you've got no clutter, and suddenly it takes you 5 seconds to find anything you own, which is pretty great. Other uses for it too. Now, it's these small things that trying to get a label onto these surfaces, if it's an irregular plastic surface with little grooves, it's not going to stick. I've tried so many different types of labels that claim to be able to wrap around cables, and they don't, they just come off after a month, which is its own kind of infuriating because no one, including me, really wants to be doing this as like an ongoing thing. We want to do it once and get it running and then take care of our system. So relabeling things is the most, you feel like there is a million and one things I would rather be doing right now. So the last resort is engraving and paint markers. Now, paint markers we talked about in a previous episode, there are these things called industrial grade markers. And these stood out to me as, rather than try to engrave things, which seems very overkill and potentially not a great idea in a small space, let's try markers first, and actually good markers. Now, similarly to my label endeavors, I've gone through a surprising amount of markers that all say that they're permanent, they'll stick on everything, and then you write on something and then it's gone in a few weeks. So here are the failure modes, as we call them. Number one, I use a lot of Ziploc bags. These are used for, let's say, the micro HDMI adapters. If I have a few of them, I'll put them in a small little baggie and I will just write a number on that. I found that this is, for some reason, things that general permanent markers just don't work on. I did find one that did work. It's called the Sakura Identity Pen, and I had it mentally boxed away as the only one that reliably works. Everything else, I'd write it, it looked great, put it in the box, and then you'd, you know, reach for your thing in a month and find that the marking had mysteriously just like faded, or by the simple process of lightweight abrasion, you touching, moving things around in that box, it completely faded. So that's number one. Why is it that it's such a hard surface? Here's number two. So I picked up these Edding and Sakura paint pens. For outdoor use, I was told that these are like the gold standard. These just won't come off. And that's another interesting surface that challenges markings. And we have a great test bed here in Jerusalem where we have an insane amount of sun for a lot of the year. So I have a few little ones outside. Now, the Edding and Sakura ones are supposed to be really, really tough. And outdoors in my field tests so far, they seem to be holding up. Here's where I'm surprised that they don't work. So I went to my local stationery store, a place I've now been in a few times in the last few months. And I got a few little, pencil cases, basically, so that I could keep my new collection of different types of markers. I have colored paint pens, non-paint pens. And I just took one of them. It's a black paint pen from Edding. Now, these have a kind of sheeny surface, like that kind of fake metallic thing going on. But this is one of the Eddings that said it would write and everything. Long story short, I wrote just a simple label on them, or a name, like paint pen markers, oil-based paint pen markers, non-oil based. Left them for 2 days because it said you want to really give them time to properly set. And to my surprise today, when I checked up on them on the kitchen table, they were smudged. And when I ran my finger over them, they just came straight off. And I was like, wait, this is supposed to be like the most durable marker in the world. So Herman and Corin, I don't know. This is strange to me. Xylene, non-xylene, paint, non-paint. What is, in simple terms, what you want to buy to write permanently on a certain surface? Is it the case that markers are just inherently flaky? Because I thought permanent markers do what they say on the tin. And let's talk about these two failure modes and other failure modes. If one wanted, if you were in the similar situation to me, let's take somebody with a decent collection of tools. I also have our home tools organized now. You want to, you know, they're going to be sitting some stuff outdoors, maybe some stuff indoors for your home lab gear, your networking gear, and you don't want to ever have to write a label twice. You don't mind buying a few different kinds that are going to stand up to different things. What would you be buying, and what's the bottom line for how to know what marker will actually adhere permanently, reliably to any given surface, whether we're talking plastic, aluminium oxide, metal, and whatever else you might encounter in these environments.
Daniel sent us this one, and I'll be honest, I read it and thought, finally, someone's asking the question that's been quietly driving me insane. He's built this elaborate home inventory system, home box fork, everything gets a number, storage boxes get numbers, and the whole thing hinges on one deceptively simple problem, getting a mark to stay on a surface. And it won't.
This is one of those topics where the more you dig, the more you realize the word permanent is doing an almost criminal amount of heavy lifting in the marketing. I went down a rabbit hole on this. We're talking polymer chemistry, surface energy, the difference between adhesion and absorption. And honestly, most of what's sold as permanent marker is permanent only if you never touch it, never expose it to light, and ideally seal it in a vacuum chamber.
The Schrödinger's marker. Simultaneously permanent and gone.
Let's start with the two failure modes. The prompt describes, because they're actually completely different chemical problems masquerading as the same frustration. The Ziploc bag situation, writing on a plastic bag, the mark looks great. A month later, it's vanished. And then the pencil case situation, where an Edding paint pen that's supposed to write on everything just wipes right off a shiny surface after 2 days of curing.
These are the industrial grade ones. The ones that cost more than the pencil case they're marking.
The Edding 751 paint marker and the Sakura versions. These are what industrial maintenance crews use. They're not supposed to fail. So when they do, it's telling us something specific about the surface chemistry.
Walk me through the Ziploc failure first. Why does a Sharpie or generic permanent marker just...
The short answer is polyolefins. Ziploc bags are made from polyethylene, specifically low-density polyethylene for the flexible body of the bag. Polyethylene and polypropylene are what chemists call low-surface energy plastics. Their surface energy is around 29 to 31 dynes per centimeter. Most permanent marker inks have a surface tension that's higher than that, which means the ink literally can't wet the surface properly. It beads up microscopically.
It's sitting on top like water on wax.
Because polyethylene is also non-porous, there's nothing for the ink to bite into. You're relying entirely on weak van der Waals forces to hold the pigment particles in place. The slightest mechanical abrasion, even just sliding against another bag in a storage box, and those particles come right off. The ink isn't fading chemically. It's being physically removed, particle by particle.
Which explains why it looks great when you first write it. And then gradually, mysteriously, it's just... you're not imagining it. It's literally flaking off at a microscopic level.
Here's where the Sakura IdentiPen is interesting. The prompt mentions it's the only one that reliably works on Ziploc bags. Sakura uses a different solvent system. It's xylene-based, which means it can actually etch into the polyethylene surface slightly. The solvent partially dissolves and swells the polymer at the surface, allowing the pigment to become mechanically locked in when the solvent evaporates and the polymer rehardens.
It's not adhesion in the sticky sense. It's more like welding.
That's exactly the right way to think about it. The solvent creates a microscopic interlocking structure at the surface. The pigment gets trapped in the polymer matrix itself. You'd have to actually remove a layer of the plastic to get the mark off.
Which brings us to failure mode. Number 2, the one that really seems to have stumped the prompt. The Edding paint pen on the shiny pencil case. This is an oil-based paint marker. It says it writes on everything. 2 days of curing, and it wipes right off with a finger. What's happening there?
This one's almost certainly a surface contamination problem, and I want to be specific about this because it's the thing most people never think about. Those shiny pencil cases, the kind of fake metallic thing going on, as the prompt describes it, are typically made from PVC or polyurethane with a metallic effect top coat. And here's the key. During manufacturing, these things are sprayed with a release agent. It's a thin layer of silicone or stearate compound that prevents the material from sticking to the mold during production.
The marker isn't even touching the plastic. It's touching the release agent.
And oil-based paint markers, for all their durability, are terrible at penetrating silicone release agents. The paint cures on top of the contaminant layer, and then when you run your finger over it, the whole thing just shears off at the contaminant interface. It's not that the marker failed, it's that it never reached the surface in the first place.
That's almost more infuriating than if it just didn't work.
It really is, because the fix is so simple and nobody tells you about it. You need to clean the surface first. Not just wipe it. You need to use isopropyl alcohol, at least 70% concentration, and literally scrub the surface to remove that release agent. On some plastics, a quick pass with very fine steel wool or a melamine sponge, a magic eraser, can also microabrade the surface and give the paint something to grip onto.
We've got two completely different failure modes. Low surface energy on polyethylene, and release agent contamination on PVC. And from the user's perspective, they look identical. You write something, it disappears. You conclude markers don't work.
That's before we even get to the outdoor problem. The prompt mentions the Jerusalem testbed, which is actually a brutal proving ground. Intense UV exposure for much of the year. Most permanent marker pigments are organic dyes, and organic dyes get absolutely destroyed by ultraviolet radiation. The UV photons break the chemical bonds in the dye molecules. It's called photodegradation, and the color literally bleaches out.
Even if the marker adheres perfectly, the sun will just...
Over time, yes. Unless you're using a pigment-based marker rather than a dye-based one. This is the fundamental distinction that almost no consumer packaging makes clear. Dye-based inks use molecules dissolved in the solvent. Each one is vulnerable to UV attack. Pigment-based inks use solid particles suspended in the binder, often inorganic compounds like carbon black, iron oxide, titanium dioxide. These are essentially tiny rocks. UV doesn't break them down nearly as easily.
The outdoor markers? The Edding and Sakura paint pens that are holding up outside? Those are pigment-based.
The Edding 751 uses a pigmented acrylic binder system. When the solvent evaporates, the acrylic polymerizes into a solid film with the pigment particles embedded in it. It's basically a thin layer of plastic with rocks in it. That's why it survives outdoors.
Which is the point where I have to ask, if we're going to this much trouble, why not just use a label maker?
Because labels have their own failure modes, and the prompt is very specific about this. The things being marked are small, irregular electronic adapters, XLR to 3.5mm, micro HDMI to mini HDMI. These have curved surfaces, grooves, ridges. A label, even an industrial one with aggressive adhesive, can only make full contact on a flat or gently curved surface. On something like a cable adapter with complex geometry, the label is making contact at a few points, and the rest is just floating. Over time, temperature cycling, the adapter gets warm during use, cools down afterward, causes the adhesive to creep, and the label peels off from the edges.
The prompt mentions cable wrap labels that claim to solve this, and then don't.
The cable wrap labels use a flag-style design where you wrap the label around the cable and it adheres to itself. The problem is that the adhesive-to-adhesive bond is strong, but the adhesive-to-cable bond is the same weak link. The whole assembly just slides along the cable or rotates. It's a mechanical failure, not a chemical one.
We're back to markers, but now we know that different surfaces need different markers, and even the same surface might need preparation. Let me try to synthesize this into something actually useful. If someone has a home inventory system, tools, cables, adapters, boxes, and they want to mark things once and never think about it again, what's the decision tree?
I'd break it into four surface categories, each needing a different approach. Category 1, porous surfaces. Wood, cardboard, paper, uncoated metal that's been lightly oxidized. These are easy. Almost any permanent marker works because the ink absorbs into the surface. You're relying on absorption and mechanical locking within the pores.
The easy case.
Category 2, low surface energy plastics. Polyethylene, polypropylene, your Ziploc bags, plastic storage bins, polyethylene cable jackets. For these, you need a marker with a solvent that can etch the surface. Xylene-based markers are the standard here. The Sakura IdentiPen uses xylene. The Edding 800 series also uses xylene. These solvents partially dissolve the polymer surface and create that mechanical interlock we talked about.
If you can't find those specific brands,
look for xylene on the marker or in the safety data sheet. If a marker says low odor or xylene free, it's going to fail on polyethylene. The low odor markers use alcohol-based solvents which evaporate too quickly and don't etch polyolefins at all. The odor is the price of adhesion. Category 3, high surface energy but non-porous surfaces. Metals, glass, ceramics, PVC. For these, paint markers are ideal. The Edding 751, the Sakura paint marker, the Uni paint marker. These use an oil or acrylic binder that cures into a solid film. But, and this is the part everyone skips, you have to clean the surface first. Isopropyl alcohol, a lint-free cloth, scrub it down. If it's a new manufactured item, assume there's a release agent on it.
Category 4 is the outdoor stuff.
Category 4, anything that's going to see sunlight, rain, temperature extremes. For this, you want pigment-based paint markers specifically. Not dye-based, pigment-based. The Edding 751 is pigment-based. The Sakura PenTouch is pigment-based. And for absolute maximum durability, after the paint has fully cured, give it a full 48 hours. You can apply a clear UV-resistant top coat over the marking. Just a tiny brush of clear acrylic sealer. It adds a sacrificial layer that takes the UV damage instead of the pigment.
That's dedication. A top coat for your label.
It sounds obsessive, but think about the alternative. The prompt describes spending an hour searching through boxes for one tiny adapter. If a $10 marker and 30 seconds of surface prep saves you that hour even once, you're ahead. If it saves you that hour five times over the life of the item, the return on investment is astronomical.
There's a deeper point here about the psychology of these systems. The prompt mentions that relabeling things makes you feel like there are a million and one things I would rather be doing right now. And that's the kill switch for any organizational system. The moment maintenance becomes annoying, the system dies.
This is why I think the marker question is actually more important than the software question. You can have the most elegant inventory database in the world, but if the physical markings fail, the whole thing collapses. The database becomes a list of things you theoretically own but can't find.
The ghost inventory. Items that exist in the system, but not in any locatable physical reality.
That's worse than no system at all, because now you're maintaining a fiction. You're updating records for things that are effectively lost. The cognitive overhead of a broken system is higher than the cognitive overhead of no system.
Let's talk about what the prompt specifically asks for. If you're equipping yourself for a home inventory system, what's the actual shopping list?
I'd recommend 4 items, and this is going to sound like a lot, but each one solves a specific problem. First, a xylene-based permanent marker for polyethylene and polypropylene surfaces. Sakura IdentiPen in black is the one the prompt already found works. Stick with it. Second, an oil-based paint marker for metals, glass, and PVC. The Edding 751 or the Sakura Pen Touch. Get a fine tip. You're marking small items, not shipping crates. Third, a small bottle of isopropyl alcohol, 90% or higher, and some lint-free wipes. This is not optional. This is the surface prep that makes everything else work. Fourth, for the absolute worst-case surfaces, the things that nothing will stick to, keep a few sheets of adhesive vinyl label stock and a pair of scissors. Sometimes the best solution is to create a flat surface where none exists.
That last one is a concession to reality.
There are some surfaces, silicone rubber, certain fluoropolymers, surfaces that are constantly flexing, where no marker will ever work reliably. For those, you create a flag label by wrapping a small piece of vinyl around the cable or component and writing on that. The vinyl adhesive is engineered for low surface energy plastics. It's not elegant, but it works.
The prompt also mentions engraving as a last resort, and seems to think it's overkill. But I wonder if that's actually true for certain items.
For metal tools, engraving is genuinely the most durable option. An electric engraver costs $20 or $30, and the mark is literally cut into the metal. It can't rub off, it can't fade, it can't be removed by solvents. For a set of wrenches or screwdrivers that are going to see hard use, engraving is probably easier than trying to find a marker that will survive the abuse.
For the tiny adapters, the micro HDMI to mini HDMI connectors. You're not going to engrave those. There's no surface area.
And that's where the fine tip paint marker is the sweet spot. A dot of paint with a number on it keyed to the inventory system. It's small enough to fit on the connector housing, durable enough to survive being tossed in a bag of adapters.
Let me ask about a failure mode the prompt didn't mention, but I've run into. What about marking on rubber, like the rubberized coating on some tool handles, or silicone cables?
Rubber and silicone are the nightmare surfaces. Rubberized coatings often contain plasticizers, oils that keep the rubber flexible, and those plasticizers migrate to the surface over time. Any mark you make will essentially float on a thin layer of oil and eventually lift off. Silicone has extremely low surface energy, lower even than polyethylene, and almost nothing bonds to it chemically.
Those surfaces are just...
For direct marking, yes. You need a mechanical solution, a tie-on tag, a heat shrink label, something that physically attaches rather than chemically bonds. Heat shrink tubing with a printed label inside it is actually a great solution for cables. You slide the tubing over the cable, write on it or print a label, and then heat it. The tubing shrinks and grips the cable mechanically. No adhesive, no surface chemistry to worry about.
I want to circle back to something about the Ziploc bag problem, because I think there's a subtlety here that matters. The prompt says the Sakura IdentiPen works, but everything else fails. But Ziploc bags aren't just polyethylene. The name brand ones often have a coating or treatment to make them easier to open, or to give them that slightly matte texture for writing on.
Ziploc brand bags specifically have a write-on label area that's been surface modified, usually by corona treatment or plasma treatment, to increase the surface energy. If you write on that patch, even a standard permanent marker will work reasonably well. But if you write on the untreated part of the bag, or on a generic brand bag that doesn't have the treatment, you're back to the low surface energy problem.
Which means the failure might be inconsistent even within the same box of bags.
You write on the label patch, it works. You write 2 inches to the left, it fails. And you conclude that markers are unreliable, when actually you're just seeing the difference between treated and untreated polyethylene.
The lesson here seems to be that permanent marker, as a category, is a lie, but a very specific kind of lie. It's not that the markers don't work. It's that permanent is always conditional on the surface, the preparation, and the environment. And none of that is on the package.
The packaging says permanent on most surfaces, and the word most is doing an enormous amount of work. What they mean is permanent on paper, cardboard, and a few other things we tested in the lab. They don't mean permanent on the polypropylene handle of your favorite screwdriver that's been absorbing hand oils for 5 years.
There's another invisible contaminant.
Human skin oils are a major adhesion killer. If you've handled an item, you've deposited a thin layer of sebum on it. Paint and ink don't bond well to sebum. This is why even on metal tools, you should wipe the surface with alcohol before marking. It's not just manufacturing residue, it's you.
Every time I think we've found the bottom of this, there's another layer.
Welcome to surface science. It's a field where the answer to, why didn't this stick, is always what was on the surface that you couldn't see.
Let's talk about the outdoor test. The prompt mentions Jerusalem sun, Edding, and Sakura paint pens holding up so far. How long should those realistically last?
Under Jerusalem's UV conditions, intense, comparable to the American Southwest or the Australian Outback, a good pigment-based paint marker should last 3 to 5 years before noticeable fading. A dye-based marker might last 6 months. And it's not just UV. Outdoor markers also have to deal with thermal cycling. The paint film expands and contracts at a different rate than the substrate. Over time, that differential expansion can cause micro-cracking, and then moisture gets in and accelerates the failure.
Even the best outdoor marker has a lifespan.
Everything has a lifespan. The question is whether the lifespan is longer than the useful life of the item you're marking. For a plastic storage bin that lives outdoors, 3 to 5 years is probably enough. The bin itself might be getting brittle and cracked by then. For a metal tool you expect to pass down to your children, you might want to engrave it.
I want to address something the prompt touches on that I think is the real emotional core here. The frustration of doing this work and having it fail is disproportionate to the actual cost of the marker. It's not about the money. It's about the feeling that you tried to be organized. You did the thing, you followed the system, and the world just unmade your effort.
There's a term for this in human-computer interaction research. It's called the cost of coordination breakdown. When an organizational system fails, the user doesn't just lose the benefit of the system. They also lose the time they invested in setting it up, and they experience a psychological penalty that makes them less likely to trust similar systems in the future. It's a triple loss.
Getting the marker right isn't a trivial detail. It's the difference between a system that reinforces itself and a system that trains you to stop using it.
This is why I think the prompt's question, what would you be buying, is actually asking something deeper. It's asking, how do I make this system trustworthy? How do I know, when I put something away with a number on it, that the number will still be there when I need it? That's a question about reliability engineering, not just about markers.
Let's answer it properly. If you want a marking system that's trustworthy, you need to think in layers. Layer 1 is surface preparation, the alcohol wipe, the abrasion, the removal of contaminants. Layer 2 is marker selection, matching the marker chemistry to the surface chemistry. Layer 3 is protection, the UV top coat for outdoor items, the placement of the mark where it won't experience abrasion. And layer 4 is fallback, having a plan for the surfaces where markers simply won't work.
That's a really good framework. And I'd add a layer 0, which is testing. Before you mark 50 items, mark one and abuse it. Rub it, flex it, leave it in the sun, get it wet. Find out if your chosen marker and surface are compatible before you commit.
Destructive testing for home organization. I love it.
It sounds excessive, but it takes 5 minutes and it saves you from the slow motion heartbreak of opening a box a month later and finding all your labels have turned into ghost marks.
Let's get specific about some products because the prompt asks for concrete recommendations. The Sakura Identity Pen. That's the xylene based one for polyethylene. What's the actual product name or number someone should look for?
It's the Sakura Identi Pen Permanent Marker, and the key thing to look for is that it says xylene-based, or you can check the safety data sheet. It comes in black, red, blue, and green. The black is the most fade-resistant because carbon black pigment is basically indestructible. The fine point version is better for small items. They're usually around $4 to $6 per pen.
The Edding 751.
That's the Edding 751 paint marker. It's an oil-based, pigment-based paint marker with an acrylic binder. It comes in multiple tip sizes. The extra fine or fine is what you want for adapters and small tools. These are more expensive, usually $8 to $12 per marker, but they last a long time because the paint is highly opaque and a little goes a long way. The key specification is that it's rated for outdoor use and resistant to heat up to something like 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit once cured.
1,000 degrees? That seems like overkill for a pencil case.
It's designed for marking engine parts and industrial equipment. The fact that it also works on your pencil case is just a happy side effect of the engineering.
What about the UniPaint marker? You mentioned that one.
The UniPaint marker. The PX20 or PX30 is another oil-based paint marker that's widely available. It's slightly less expensive than the Edding, and it's very good on metal and glass. The tip is a bit broader, so it's better for larger items. For the tiny adapters, the prompt describes, I'd stick with the Edding Extra Fine or the Sakura Pen Touch Extra Fine.
If someone can't find these specific brands, what's the generic specification they should look for?
For polyethylene and polypropylene, xylene-based permanent marker, check the label or the safety data sheet online. If it says xylene-free or low odor, put it back. For metals, glass, and outdoor use, oil-based paint marker, pigment-based, with an acrylic or alkyd binder. If the marker says water-based or dye-based, it's not going to survive outdoors. For everything, buy a bottle of isopropyl alcohol and use it before you mark.
That's remarkably straightforward once you know the vocabulary.
That's the thing about surface chemistry. The concepts aren't complicated. It's surface energy, porosity, contamination, UV degradation. But nobody teaches you the vocabulary, so you're standing in the stationary aisle staring at 50 markers that all say permanent, and you have no way to distinguish them.
The word permanent has been so thoroughly abused in marketing that it's become meaningless. It's like natural on food packaging. It tells you nothing except that the manufacturer thinks you want to hear it.
We have the chemistry. We've had it for decades. The xylene-based markers have been around since the 1960s. The paint markers since the 70s. The knowledge exists. It's just not communicated to consumers.
Because communicating it would require admitting that the cheaper markers aren't actually permanent on the surfaces most people want to mark.
The 10-cent Sharpie is permanent on paper. It's not permanent on polyethylene, polypropylene, PVC, metal, glass, rubber, silicone, or anything that's been outdoors for more than a summer. But if the package said permanent on paper and some other things, nobody would buy it.
The prompt mentions that the Sakura IdentiPen was mentally boxed away as the only one that works on Ziploc bags. And it sounds like that's actually correct. It's not a fluke. It's the xylene.
It's the xylene. And the reason most other markers don't use xylene anymore is regulatory. Xylene is a volatile organic compound. It's not great to inhale in large quantities. California's Proposition 65 requires warnings on products containing xylene. So manufacturers move to alcohol-based solvents, which are safer but don't etch polyolefins. The safety improvement came at the cost of performance.
If you're using a xylene marker, use it in a ventilated area.
Don't huff it. But for marking a few items in a room with an open window, the exposure is negligible. The dose makes the poison.
I want to go back to the pencil case failure one more time, because I think there's a lesson there that applies broadly. The prompt mentions leaving the markers for 2 days to cure, exactly what the instructions say. And they still wiped off. So even following the instructions perfectly, the mark failed. What does that tell us?
It tells us that the instructions assume a clean surface and the surface wasn't clean. The cure time is about the paint film forming properly, the solvent evaporating, the binder polymerizing. But none of that matters if the paint is sitting on top of a layer of silicone release agent. The paint can cure perfectly and still fail because it's cured onto the wrong thing.
It's like building a house with a perfect foundation on top of a sheet of ice.
The foundation is solid, but it's not attached to the ground. And this is the thing that I think most people miss about surface preparation. It's not a nice to have. For many surfaces, it's the difference between the mark lasting forever and the mark lasting until the first time you touch it.
The prompt situation, marking the outside of pencil cases that are themselves holding markers, is almost poetic. The marker fails to mark the thing that holds the markers.
It's a perfect illustration of the problem. The pencil case has that shiny, slightly slippery feel specifically because of the additives and coatings that make it look good on the store shelf. Those same additives are what make it impossible to mark. The thing was designed to be attractive, not to be writable.
Which is true of approximately everything in modern life. Surfaces are designed for aesthetics and manufacturability, not for writability.
The few surfaces that are designed for writability, the Ziploc label patch, the matte area on a FedEx envelope, are explicitly engineered that way. It's not an accident. It's a deliberate surface treatment that costs money. The fact that it exists at all tells you that the untreated surface is known to be a problem.
What's the bottom line for someone who's listening to this and thinking, I just want to organize my tools and cables and not think about chemistry?
The bottom line is four things. 1. Clean the surface with alcohol. 2. For plastic bags and bins, use a xylene-based marker like the Sakura Identi Pen. 3. For metal, glass, and outdoor stuff, use a pigment-based paint marker like the Edding 751. 4. For rubber, silicone, and anything that flexes constantly, use a physical label or heat-shrink tubing instead of a marker.
If you do all of that and it still fails, you've found a difficult surface, and you should probably just use a tie-on tag.
Or engrave it. Honestly, for metal tools, an electric engraver is cheap and the mark is literally forever. It's not overkill if it solves the problem permanently.
Permanently. In the actual sense of the word, not the market package sense.
There's permanent, and then there's permanent.
One thing I'm still curious about. The prompt mentions having tried so many different types of labels before arriving at markers. We've focused on markers, but are there label materials that actually work on those irregular surfaces?
There are, but they're not consumer grade. Industrial labeling systems like the Brady BMP21 or the Brother P-Touch industrial line use label cartridges with aggressive adhesives designed for low surface energy plastics. The Brady labels, in particular, use a 3M adhesive rated for polyethylene and polypropylene. The label stock itself is a flexible polyolefin, so it can conform to slight curves. But even these have limits. They need a certain amount of flat surface area to bond to, and they're not cheap. A Brady label cartridge can run $40 or $50.
It's either expensive labels or the right marker and some surface prep. The marker starts to look like the economical choice.
For small, irregular items, absolutely. The marker is a fraction of a cent per mark. It works on curved surfaces, and with the right chemistry, it's effectively permanent. The label is better for flat surfaces where you want a machine-printed, scannable code. But for the kind of items the prompt describes, loose adapters, small cables, connectors, a fine-tip paint marker is the tool for the job.
I think there's also a philosophical point here about the nature of these organizational systems. The prompt mentions that the system was forked from Homebox, which is designed for QR codes. QR codes are great when they work. You scan them with your phone, you get the item record instantly. But they're fragile. A smudge, a scratch, a bit of UV fading, and the code is unreadable. A handwritten number is more robust. It's lower tech, but it degrades gracefully. Even if half the number is worn off, you can probably still read it.
That's a really important point about system design. QR codes are a high-bandwidth, low-resilience solution. They encode a lot of information, but they need near-perfect readability. A human-readable number is low-bandwidth but high-resilience. You can read it even if it's partially damaged. For a home inventory system, the number is all you need. The database does the rest. You're not trying to encode the entire item record on the item itself.
The item just needs a unique identifier. Everything else lives in software.
That's why the marker approach works so well. You're not asking the mark to do anything except survive and be readable. A single number written clearly in a durable medium on a prepared surface. That's a solved problem.
Provided you know which marker to use.
Which, hopefully, we've now answered.
I think we have. Xylene for polyethylene, pigment-based paint for metal and outdoors, alcohol for everything, and if that fails, engrave it or tag it.
Test one before you do 50.
Test one before you do 50. Words to live by. And now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
The world's largest bat colony by population is Bracken Cave in Texas, home to roughly 20 million Mexican free-tailed bats. But the largest single-chamber bat roost ever documented was discovered in the 1880s on Russia's Yamal Peninsula. where a limestone sinkhole housed an estimated 30 million soprano pipistrelles before a partial collapse dispersed the colony.
30 million bats in one hole. That's not a colony, that's a nation.
I have so many questions about how you count 30 million bats in the 1880s. Did someone volunteer? This has been My Weird Prompts, produced by Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps other people find the show. Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.